And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time, and while we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D is also our second home that we've built from the ground up.
I'm Ange.
Wait, hold on one second. Two, I'm here. What's going on? I feel ignored.
I mean, we'll get to you. We'll get to you.
Okay.
Because you've got more than just me and Jared.
It's true.
You've got Chris today.
Yay.
So I'm Ange. I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, a Stew's podcast, since 2017. In 2021, I became head gnome in... Did we start this in 2022? 2022, we started this, and yeah, I like gaming. I play games.
Ange plays lots of games. I'm Chris, by the way. I edit this show, unfortunately, sometimes, like this intro that I destroyed. I also edit the Heroes of Havel's Way, and I am your dungeon master for that podcast. I think a lot about how to help people play their best games. And I guess if it matters, I started Misdirected Mark Productions, which became the Polygamers Podcast Network over a decade ago, but that's like super old news and nobody cares.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew. All of this has happened before, and it will happen again. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoiknowgr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
Was that a Wheel of Time reference?
Actually, it was more of a Battlestar Galactica.
Also relevant. That's true. Okay. All right.
After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about more homebrew, including our actual play setting, the Heroes of Havel's Way.
Yay.
Yay. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND the Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
In Search of the Unknown was an adventure that came out in 1978, and for a while, it was the included adventure in the 1981 basic set. This adventure was a little bit different than other adventures that would be published, because while there was a framing device describing why the PCs would show up and what they might find, the adventure itself included rooms and caves without any key. Now, there was advice for the DM to guide them toward what encounters should be placed in those empty spaces. This was because it was meant to be a teaching tool that provided the DM with some momentum. Unfortunately, one thing the adventure didn't do was teach the DM how to pronounce the name of the location where it takes place. Quasquentin? Quasquentin? Quaquitian? Quasquit? I don't know. I mean, phonetics would be great. Please, thank you.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, moving into our campaign journal, I got to play Jared's Marodi game and the Cygnus du Gore game. I'll let Jared talk about his game, but I'll cover the Monkeys of War. We are currently in the Underdark, so this session was mostly us fighting drow. We discovered a fortress of some kind in the next large cavern. We debated a moment on what to do about it, but since they were using demons as guard dogs, it probably wasn't worth trying to have a conversation. The first fight actually went down really quick. Selena, my fighter, and Wonder, our tabaxi rogue, dealt with a vrock really quickly, while Bryn, our half-orc sorcerer, dropped a fireball on a tower that took out all the soldiers and the wizard that was in there. One more person hit the vrock, we were done with that, and got into the fort and ended up fighting a whole bunch of stuff. There were giant spiders, elite soldiers, a wizard, some more vrocks, a bunch of standard soldiers, and a creepy demon. The rest of that fight pretty much took the rest of the session, and we ended pretty much as soon as we were done with that, so we haven't really had a chance to talk with the prisoners they had or the captives or anything like that. I do think Selena might be a lesson in be careful what you give your players, because I joke that she has Pathfinder levels of AC, but on top of that, I was able to get her a Cloak of Displacement. So not only does the GM need to hit a 25 to hit her, he also has to roll at disadvantage each round until she's been hit the first time.
First game the Game Master's run, right?
No, it's not the first he's run. He's run stuff before. This is probably the first one he's run long-term like this.
Because last time I checked, there's a whole bunch of other things that you can do to characters other than try to hit them with attack rolls, like make them make a bunch of saving throws.
Oh, yeah, he'll do that, too. He does that, too. but I do start to feel a little guilty when we're in a combat and Selena is literally surrounded by six elite soldiers and they can't touch her.
It's funny. All I would do is cast spells on you. As soon as the drow saw what you were, I'm like, oh, we're just going to throw spells right there all day.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the wizard got himself trapped in a room with the Baxi rogue,
There's only one wizard. There needs to be like 12 spellcasters. Like what?
The Tabaxi rogue is a swashbuckler, and one of the facets of a swashbuckler rogue is that they actually get their sneak attack damage when they are the only person facing an enemy.
Yeah, man, they're duelists. That's great.
Yeah, so like that wizard was that wizard was dead. Swiss cheese within moments in that room.
He'll learn. There needs to be three or four wizards. It's fine. He'll get it.
In other news, I'm working on a Tales of the Valiant campaign that will probably start happening in January. Basically, Scott, the GM of Cygnus de Gior, I've been running this close to 2 years. So I'm like, let's give you a break. Let you play for a little bit. I'm going to be using the Tales of the Old Margreave and running that. So be on the lookout for me to start talking about that in a couple of months.
I hear there's a blog post that somebody wrote that ran that whole campaign and has ideas about how.
It's been useful. It's been useful.
Some weird review gnome guy, I heard, did it. I don't know. If you go to our Discord, it's probably like linked there in the blog section. Just throw it out there.
In our Marodi Empire campaign, which is still D&D 2014, because I asked everybody just in case we wanted to see if we were going to switch over rules, and we are not for now. After multiple delays, the encounter that never ends finally ended. So to recap, the PCs were trying to rescue their friends and family members that had been kidnapped and placed in an abandoned temple, which was set on fire. They're fighting the paladins of the Order of the Humble Knights of Searing Truth.
Jerks.
There's three officers on the scene. So there was a cleric, there is the leader of the order locally, and there was a sergeant. As long as any one of them was not incapacitated, more minions would show up at the end of every turn. We just kept having minions show up until they took out the officers from there.
They're like the spawn points in Gauntlet. Mm-hmm.
And basically I was doing that because I wanted it to seem like they are swarming this entire district.
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
The Ratatosk Bard, which is our little squirrel person, had just talked to the local authorities, telling them, hey, we're not the problems here. Can you do something to help out? They take off to go find somebody else because this is above their pay grade. But they didn't, you know, rush in and assume the PCs were something that needed to be taken care of. Every time someone would free one of their friends or family members, I was using the retainer stat blocks from the MCDM products. These were interesting. I'll let Anne speak to them. I don't know that I would use them again, but I did. I thought it was interesting to just try and use them to see how they worked, because it's basically they have a certain number of hit points based on what level the person controlling them has. They have different powers based on what level the person controlling them has. They have like a signature ability, and they have other abilities that they can either use once a day or three times a day. And they're all basically flavored so that you're not using something from a class, but it seems like something from a class.
I kept looking for the abilities that I expected Anezik to have, because she is supposed to also be a rogue. And I kept looking for, and like, oh no, she doesn't have that. She has something else. I think they worked for what we were doing for them, but I think long term they were a little limited for the characters they were being used for.
Yeah, and you know, I was experimenting on all of you by seeing how these rules felt. So that's what I used for the
fine.
NPCs.
Companion NPCs are hard, right? Like I've been playing around with it in our game a ton.
Yeah, because I don't want them to be as detailed as the PCs, but like Andrew was saying, you also don't want them to feel like they don't have key abilities that you would expect them to have.
This sounds like a whole episode that you should do.
It does. Eventually, the PCs did manage to take out the last of the knights, but all of my probability for years and years of having boss monsters never recharge their abilities was completely skewered in this fight because Lady Rengarag had a recharge ability. And it recharged three times in this
three
fight.
Three times.
Yeah, that was the problem with the recharge mechanic.
Yeah, it was basically It was basically an area attack smite where it would just, you know, do fire damage to everything in 30 feet of her. It was dangerous for the PCs. It was more dangerous for the NPCs that they were running because she dropped two of them like twice, which I actually kind of liked because it created some tension that wasn't necessarily just the PCs potentially dying off. It was, you know, you keeping your friends and family members alive.
Yeah, and it made sense because the friends and family we were rescuing were all competent characters. They're all competent, maybe not adventurers in their own right, but they are competent, skilled characters. So the moment they were freed, they ran to help because they weren't just going to sit there and cower in a corner. But it made them more vulnerable in that fight with her dropping those constantly.
And it did feel very thematically appropriate that the fight really boiled down to a handful of minions left and then just Lady Rengarag surrounded by all the PCs just trying to nickel and dime her to death so that she didn't have a chance to recharge that ability again.
That's funny. Yeah, that recharge mechanic, it's cool because it creates a certain kind of tension, mm-hmm. right? But it also is unpredictable. So, like, it can change the difficulty of an encounter from being, you know, easy to medium to being very difficult in a flash.
It is interesting because that's one of the things in Tales of the Valiant. If you use Doom, you can use Doom to recharge something automatically. And I've played around with this idea before where it's like, I would almost rather if something happens, it recharges instead of it being random.
I'm always about the bloody reaction, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
That's the counterpunch, right? Like, oh, look, we whacked the bad guy. Oh, the bad guy counterpunches. Like, oh, yeah, the bad guy can do stuff.
They are going to get to do something bad before they die now.
Which is, when you're running a game, is the super frustrating thing. If you have a bad guy on the field and, like, they don't ever get to do any of their abilities. Chris, to speak to what you're saying, Scott is learning because he is starting to make sure that his bad guys use their abilities rather than trying to like hold them back. Like we got a lightning bolt dropped on us and cloud kill and all sorts of other stuff. So he's learning. It's just, you know, the way the battle played out, Elena was the one dealing with the haters.
The thing about this game mastering thing, there's some things that you don't know until you do it a bunch of times. Like, and especially at higher levels. Like, once you get the characters, like, oh, that person's got a 25 AC, I better figure out how to deal with them to make the game interesting for them in some way, shape, or form. That's good.
Our PCs now, their next mission is going to be going undercover, which is really funny if you know these PCs. But while they are arranging the ship to smuggle them into the city that they are supposed to be going undercover in, they have some time to wait. I have, through this whole campaign, really liked to give people, hey, you have, you know, 2 weeks until you're ready to do something. I want it to feel like time is progressing. What would you like to do for downtime? The problem is, the official 5e downtime is not as robust as I would like it to be.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It is, and as Ange has pointed out,
everything is based on charisma rolls. Kazina has no charisma.
There's way too much stuff that just is not useful to people that don't have certain ability scores. So what we did this time was we started using Cubicle 7, A Life Well Lived, and the downtime stuff they have in there. And everybody seemed way happier with those downtime things. Like, there's a much better spread of ability scores that you use to resolve them. There's a lot wider range of just what would you do if you have downtime, even if it's just something simple. I mean, it seemed to go over much better this time.
There was one option in downtime, which was essentially chill.
Yeah.
You basically just hang out, meditate, rest, vibe with the world around you. And I think it gives you...
Your first save after a long rest has advantage. You're just relaxed.
Yeah, you're chill. You're one with the world. You're at peace.
You're more able to deal with the stress of a situation because of it. Makes sense.
Yeah.
And I like that because it also gives you an option. Like, I don't know what my character would do between adventures, or my character would not do anything between adventures. They would just chill out. What we ended up doing was Marin took the clean up the streets downtime activity, which he flavored as like hunting down the last members of that order that weren't arrested.
He's Batman.
Yeah. So it was basically he made a check to like investigate where they're at and to, you know, set a trap for them and then, you know, spring the trap on them. And that was kind of neat. It was fairly quick resolution to something. It's not meant to deal with like major characters, but it was kind of a neat story ribbon that you could put on there. Ivy was attempting to master a spell. And if you master a spell with downtime every day, you just get a free casting of that spell without using a spell slot. You basically just practice that spell over and over and over again. and you're just good at using it until you take your next downtime.
And it was not super easy to get that mastery.
That's one of the harder ones.
You had to succeed at several different roles to reach that level.
And then Kazina and Kratatup decided to go gambling. It was great. We were just, you know, picturing the two of them like bonding because Kratatup is a new party member. And, you know, Kazina got to take him to some of the livelier, seedier places in town. The other thing that was funny is Ivy rolled a complication on her training. What the complication was is while she was practicing her spirit guardians, so she accidentally, instead of summoning her spirit guardians, summoned an actual Valkyrie that's watching over her. She's an Asimar who is descended from Baldur, and Kratatup, our Ratatosk, is supposed to be keeping an eye on her and keeping her safe. So the Valkyrie shows up and wonders why Kratatup isn't with Ivy. So she hunts down Kratatup and chides him for not being with the person that he has been charged to watch over. And she turned him into a possum person instead of a squirrel person until he learns his lesson, which has no mechanical difference because, you know, possum person versus squirrel person, not a big difference. But I thought it was funny.
That is funny.
I mean, he is a bard. It does change his appearance, which is usually important to bards.
Also, if he's mad about it, that's good. Like, why am I a possum? Why am I not a squirrel? Sad panda.
And what was nice, too, was I came up with, like, she's going to turn you into something. What is something that would be similar to a squirrel that you would not want to be? So we even crowdsourced this answer. Nice. So it was great.
That is good.
But then unfortunately, we looked at our calendar and realized we will not be able to play again until January.
Brutal.
Yes.
Brutal.
So what do you have going on, Chris?
There's things that I've been playing. I also was on vacation, so I was in Disney. A lot of my games have not happened lately, but I wanted to talk about the release chapters of the Heroes of Howl's Way, the game we've played, since we've never actually really talked about it on the show. You can go listen to them.
We were trying very hard to not do spoilers of the game on the show, so it's like, it's this thing we're doing, but hard to talk about.
You can go listen to them, but I think we should talk about it right now. So this starts in a place called Howl's Way. It is a little town in the middle of nowhere. And by town, I mean, it's like 28 people is the population. That's how big it is. And we are definitely using the idea of like an epic fantasy starting in a small town. And then a supernatural problem crops up. There are these mud creatures called the Slurg around. And Odin Dahlia Celestine, played by Angela Murray, and Aramon Durant, played by Jared Rasher, is a druid and a paladin, respectively. They have a destiny, but it's like not over it. They have to like take it on themselves. Otherwise, the bad things will happen. That first session that we played, though, the first few chapters that are out there, or the first chapter that's out there, the Slurg show up and you start fighting them. And you're like, what are these weird mud things? And then after you've stopped that threat a little bit and then saved Mateo from a rock Slurg out in the woods, the Baroness of Castakin shows up looking for your father, Aramon, and your mentor, I suppose, Odie?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, we're old and I'm not leaving here. And take our kids and proteges. It's fine. Like, you go. I don't know. What do you guys think of? Like, you guys played these games. What do you think about if you can remember that far back? It was a long time ago now. It was like 6 months or 7 months ago. I don't even know if you guys remember those games. I do. I remember them very much.
Oh, yeah. You know what's sad is this was also much clearer back when we first started the game. But I started thinking about the whole us being the younger people that have to go out and do the thing because there are older, more accomplished people, but they're just not, you know, the active adventurers anymore. I was thinking, wow, this is so much like that Willow show that clearly didn't exist because you cannot find it on Disney Plus anymore.
Yeah, clearly didn't exist. It's unfortunate. I actually like that show.
I like that we set us up as very established in our little town. Mm-hmm. I know that some listeners were like, oh my God, so many names of villagers. Yeah. And the Beat family, like the Beat family is half the town with all their kids. But it made it feel like we were part of this little community and leaving home meant something.
Yeah, it was too many names, but it was on purpose for that reason. Like, I'm like, I would never normally do that. And I probably would never do it again and find a different way to go about making that feel like that. But I like Ange said, I think it was pretty effective in getting that across.
Mm-hmm.
But after you leave with the Baroness and Jared's character's romantic interest, Robin, which we can talk about. We'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that when we actually get into the Dungeon Master's Workshop. You go to Crossing, and that allowed me to let you see a small part of the larger world. And I started to introduce other problems, like the bandits. Plus, it lets you guys get to slap some bandits around, which is always fun. and then show off some more of the supernatural symptoms of what's going on in the setting and let you guys take part in the game, which was, you know, there's a bit of an investigation going on. You have to track down these bandits. And then, you know, shenanigans ensue as Jared is having his character climb up trees and leap onto buildings and make lots of noise. And Odie is casting entangle spells on the doors and on the doorways to try to, like, keep the bad guys from walking in. But, like, the entanglement, like, after the door got broken open, there was a moment where Odie shuts the door. And then on the bandit's next turn, the bandit just opens the door back up. I mean, it was effective for Odie shutting the door and then getting away so that she didn't take an opportunity attack, which was, you know, really the point, but it was just kind of funny.
I'm just going to say, like, looking over the course of the adventure, we have some great door moments.
There have been some great door moments. We can't talk about some of the other ones yet, but there have been some great door moments.
I think one of the things I loved about that early stage of, you know, leaving Hovel's Way to go to Crossing and then in Crossing and dealing with the bandits is kind of having both of us understand a little more about our characters and the things they were going to be doing. Because, like, the first time we fought bandits, Aramon struggled with that. Because this was the first time he killed a human being. Whereas Odie was more like, huh, yeah, that wasn't pleasant, but okay, let's move on.
Yep.
You know, very different ways that the two characters kind of approach this type of thing.
Plus, it let me use some of the NPCs to highlight relationships and also be a foil to the other characters, like with Emma and Robin. Robin's concern for Aramon and Emma being a little bit more on the bloodthirsty side. Like, she likes the fight. She enjoys the thrill of the fight. But then you got to deal with the bandits, and I let you guys also impact the setting, if in small ways, meaningful ways, like the kid with the farm and then the grumpy old farmer that Aramon talked to. Odie and blessing that farm. I don't know if you guys remember that stuff. It's really, really good storytelling inside of the actual play. So, like, those things matter, and I'll probably have them come back up at some point in the future, even if it's just like a cutaway scene. Then there's the fight with Oliver Blair. That's the shadows that pop up, and that's when Odie, you know, shows off the fact that she can turn into a starry form, and even she doesn't realize it when she does it, which is hilarious. Because it's when Emma's like, says you're beautiful, that you, like, freak out about it a little bit.
That was, as a player, that was one of those, you know, and this was nobody's fault, but it was a frustrating thing as a player because I knew I had access to those special subclass abilities and I was planning on doing something really dramatic with it. And then he sank through the floor.
Yeah.
He went through the floor and I'm like, damn it, I can't do the thing I wanted to do. It's still dramatic and really cool, but in the moment I was like, but I had a thing I wanted to do.
I mean, you dramatically got up there and said the superhero thing, which to everybody's horror, ruining the surprise of it all, which was hilarious.
I loved that because at least at that point in time, I was expecting Aramon to be the one to say something unwise to blow our cover. Nope, yep. That was all
I mean, Chris is the game master, loved it too. But the characters of Emma and Robin and Callion, the poor guy that you had, you were using as, like, the in to all of this, who was, like, the bandit that you were trying to reform, was not okay. He was like, oh man, we're so dead. And then Odie did annihilate a shadow, like, with one shot, because, you know, shadows and light. And then you went to an island and found that dungeon, the new island that rose up out of the, and found that dungeon and went in there.
I was just gonna say, one of the things that I really have enjoyed is that Ange and I have both been kind of leaning into the whole, we don't necessarily know that we have these badass powers when we trigger them. We know we can do something, and we've both been kind of leaning into that, like, learning what we're actually able to do as it happens.
Yeah, which is part of the setting, too.
I think at the stage we're actually at in playing, I think at least Odie is starting to get a clue that this is not normal, but it's, you know, it's definitely been interesting watching this stuff evolve.
Yeah, someone's called you a Starlight Seer. The only other person that they mentioned that is similar in that way is Siobhan, who is Lohava's druid.
Yeah.
The Starseer that works for, the druid of the stars that works for her, or works with her, I should say. That is the Heroes of Hovel's Way.
And episodes will continue to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
We're going to move on into our Dungeon Master's Workshop because we're going to take some more time to talk about that game. Because as we were discussing the topic of world building the last time around, which was just a couple of episodes ago, it occurred to us that we really should have asked Chris to be on the show so we could talk about the homebrewing that he's been doing for the Heroes of the Hobble's Way game. And as we were thinking about this, it was like, well, let's just do a part two and have Chris on. So you can go listen to that episode. And maybe if you want to, you can come back and listen to us, or you can just stay here as we, you know, get into this stuff with Chris.
Yay.
What was the first thing you made for this setting? And why was that what you started with?
So the first thing was the Titan Destroyers, and I didn't specifically make it for this setting. It was just an idea that I had probably about a year before we even started talking about playing this game. It started as, what if there were five elemental-like Tarrasques running around the world? it was some combination of that plus a little Shadow of the Colossus, if folks remember that video game that Nintendo put out. That was part of the inspiration. And started there, it was just one of those ideas that I have sometimes that I just have a feeling has legs. If an idea that I have generates 100 more ideas and I get excited about it, then I know that that's a good idea, and I tend to start writing stuff down for that. I usually will think about it and like, oh, it's a good idea. And then if it comes back the next day, then it'll be something that's truly worth like going and putting down on paper and like starting to flesh out a bit. Because I mean, I have ideas all the time, but they're not ones that make me feel like that all the time.
Do you think that's common to have world building start with like a specific seed of an idea?
Common for me or common for people?
Both.
Common for me, yes. I mean, it's like two or three different ideas that come together. That I have pulled from different places, and I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds like a really cool idea, and then I get excited about it, and then I start fleshing stuff out. For other people, I mean, it's different for everybody. Like, I don't know, what do you do for your campaigns, Ange? Like, when you get an idea?
You know, the thing is I've never done a complete homebrew on my own. I have usually been in an established setting, which gives me seeds that I pull on from there. In a non-D&D game, I have done that type of world building that was like, I need to do a Supers game, and I kind of want something simple. It's the Bat family with the serial numbers filed off searching for their missing Batman. And basically from there, I basically created who their Batman was, the Night Guardian, mm-hmm. what the city was, what's going on in the city, who are the villains. It wasn't necessarily a burning idea that I needed to bring to a setting. It was more, I needed a setting for the game I needed to run in that span of time.
You had the idea, though, it was like, okay, it's the Bat family or the vigilante family of the city, but their prime vigilante is gone.
Right.
Right? That means a bunch of stuff, and then a lot of things happen because of that.
Right.
Yeah, it's cool. Like, that's pretty much how I do it. Then you just start pattern matching things. What about you, Jared?
So one of the things that I have, if you ever were to look through my Google Drive, I have so many documents that are just like, someday I want to run this outline of an adventure, or this NPC occurred to me. Once it feels right, I need to be able to slot this NPC somewhere because I like this combination of personality traits and things that I thought of for this NPC. Or sometimes I might, you know, do that with a villain. I have these documents just sitting in my Google Drive, not necessarily attached to a campaign, but every so often when I am prepping an adventure or, you know, even just starting a game to begin with, I will remember, hey, didn't I write something like that? And I'll start looking through my Google Drive and going, that was the thing. That's basically what I do. If I sit down and try to build an entire world, I would spend like 6 months straight and never get any gaming done.
Oh, yeah.
But if I just stop and think, oh, this is a good idea, I need to jot this down, I still spend too much time doing it, but I'm not, you know, it's just getting saved somewhere. I know this is an isolated thing that someday I can pull out and put in here.
There's that old school cartoon of a character on like a train, and they're laying the track in front of the train as the train goes. That is very much me as a GM, because like I have difficulty doing long-term planning. Like, I'll have ideas, like, I know a general gist of where I think things are going, but I don't really start solidifying things until I'm like, okay, I need to, what is the next thing they're going to do? Okay, speaking of my Depths of Zendrick game, okay, they're leaving the city and heading into the jungle to explore and find a place where these people can homestead. What are the type of things they're going to run into? Well, outside of the city, it's not going to be immediate jungle. They're going to find some some farms and some homesteads. Okay, so let's have a scene where they run into a little farming community that's being beset upon by ogres. They deal with that. And like from there, I end up creating, this is a little community of outcasts led by a tiefling who's very motherly. She's taken in people who, you know, were cast out of whatever community they're from and are looking for a second start. Yes, it's tough going because they're in the wilds of Zendrick and weird things are happening, but it's like they're doing what they can to stick together. And like it just, it adds this flavor to it that just makes it more than just a random encounter with ogres at a farm.
Mm-hmm. I'm much like you, Ange. Like the campaign we're playing, like I have thoughts about where things could potentially end up, but I'm basically laying track. Like I have an idea of where we're going, but I'm basically laying track just a little bit farther out than probably you do. The thing that I do is more like a, I guess like a house or a structure. Like I lay down myself a lot of foundations so that I have things that I can draw on as we're going along. That's really my trick. Like most of the stuff that I write down is just ideas that I can pull from that I, when I actually need to come up with the next scenario, because I have no idea what the characters are going to do. And that's the way that I like it. And then I have to, well, we'll talk about characters in a little bit.
It's funny because right now in October, I try and watch a new horror movie every day for the entire month. Just as an example of stuff that that ends up going into those folders that I have that are full of stuff that isn't directly connected to anything is when I watch like a show and I get an idea like, oh, I could use this for a campaign. That's a lot of times where those things come from. For example, when I watched Abigail, I was like, oh, I'm using some of this in my Curse of Strahd game.
Yep. little ballerina vampire. Absolutely. Yeah, man, beg, borrow, and steal from everywhere. That's the way that you do it. I mean, as long as you change it a little bit, if you watch anything, really, or read anything or listen to anything out there, change it 10 to 20% and you get something new. That's just kind of how creativity works.
I learned this very early on in my time as a gamer, because I started with D&D, and then when I got into college, I started playing with other people. And the very first Supers game we played, we were playing teenagers at a special school for gifted youngsters who all had superpowers. And like the GM looked at me and he's like, this is completely new. Nobody has ever done this before, right? Right? The motto back then was steal, but steal well.
I mean, you're talking about the reference to Harry Potter, right? In Hogwarts. I'm sorry. I know you're doing an X-Men thing, but I just wanted to point out that it's not just an X-Men thing, right?
You know, at the time, it was just X-Men, okay? Harry Potter was still about, Jesus, probably still about 10 years off.
Which is my point, right? I'm just making the point for you, because you're right.
You're making like, the point that I'm old, Chris.
No, I'm making the point that, yes, okay, we're both old. It's fine. You said it. I didn't. I'm not taking credit for that one.
Speaking of old, what we're dealing with has to do with some ancient events and things returning to the present. How much of the history of the setting have you fleshed out? Is it a strict timeline, or is it just kind of a vague, I know this happened before this? How does that come together?
Well, there is a 4-page PDF about the Titan Destroyers that comes out in October 2024 on the Patreon. So if it's past October 2024, you can just go join the Patreon and pick it up, like, and read it. There's history in there. That was created from about 2 pages of bullet-pointed notes, which was the setting and history stuff. So there's some timeline stuff in there, but it's vague in the sense that these things happened about 600 years ago. Also, as the story evolves and details are needed, I add in more bits. Stuff about the Zithian Empire, the elemental peoples, you've encountered some of them. Not in the audio that's out there, but that the characters have, what the Zithians did with their magic, and there's some more detailed parts of the Titan War when they're required. But the high-level moments of who the Titans are, why the war started between them and the Zithian Empire, what happened to the different Titans, and important people and places of the world, and how things ended up, and more importantly, how that affected the setting and impacts the story are things that I do have written down. Because I need to know those things so that I can, when you guys ask me questions about lore and history, I can make reasonable and consistent conversational points for you guys and put out facts that you can find.
I think when you're running something that you have created, it can be a little easier to do that if you have an idea of what should be in that scope of things. I've I've been experiencing some issues running a pre-written campaign.
Yeah.
I run into things and the players will ask me a question and I'm like, yes, I am the GM. I have the freedom to do what I want with this game. And the players will probably never have an idea that I deviated from what's written in the adventure. But at the same time, if something I do conflicts with something that is a part of a later aspect of this adventure, I've just shot myself in the foot. I think when you are running a pre-written adventure, you have all this stuff there for you. You just may not remember it all at the time, and you kind of have to scramble to keep it all in play. Whereas if you are homebrewing, you have the advantage of, yeah, you can make it up as you go, as long as it's consistent thematically with what you've already been doing, and you write it down so you don't forget.
And it's consistent with what you said previously.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm having the same problem as you are with my Masks of Nile third type game. It's like 900 pages of text that I'm trying to remember what the hell's going on all the time, yeah. So that I'm not contradicting myself.
I've been struggling with the Coriolis Mercy of the Icons adventure. We're only halfway through the first book, and I've still already like, why, where's this information? Like, you know.
So here's the trick, though. Like, when we're talking about this whole history thing, I legitimately only have 2 pages of, like, notes about the history. There's probably more now because we've played the game, and sometimes I improvise what's going on based on those 2 pages. Mm-hmm. There's, like, more detail in there, and I've had to add more things. There's also, like, a more recent history thing that matters to the setting, too, called the Conklin War, that has impacted both the characters and their, like, the Circle of Stars, the Organization of Druids, and Aramon's dad, and the Knights of Cast, the Knights of the Realm, really. So, like, there was a civil war 20 years earlier. So that, like, that matters too, right? That there's impact there also on what's going on. And so I need to know what happened there too. So there's like those 2 pieces that I have to keep in my head at least. It's not 900 pages of text. It's 2.5 pages that I wrote.
There was a thing that they did in the second edition of 7th C that I really liked that some fans were not thrilled with. And that is when they, you know, it vaguely is the same setting as from first edition, but they changed things. And one of the things that they did is they did not do a timeline. They said that certain things happened before other things, but they don't necessarily say this happened 157 years ago. They said this happened before this church split into these 2 separate religions. You know, and that's how, you know, this country existed because of this, and then this country split off from them. But they don't have like specific years in there so that they're, you know, so nobody is saying, wait, that's supposed to be 35 years ago. And you know, it could be 35 years ago, it could have been 70 years ago, as long as the general idea of what happened before what else happened is followed in that progression.
Yeah.
Not that they didn't make other mistakes in 7th C second edition, but...
That is the classic, I mean, to sidetrack for a second, that is the classic way to not run a Kickstarter campaign, by the way.
So, Chris, did we throw you any curveballs when we talked about what kind of characters we wanted to play?
Of course you did. I mean, this is a world. I mean, it's a world where magic has greatly been affected by the Titan War. You all know that there is not as much magic in your current time period as there was 600 years ago, but there's more than there was 550 years ago after the war was over. And you guys picked Paladin and Druid. I haven't even considered the gods, and Druid is one of the most complex magical classes in the game, and over a whole decade of running 5th edition D&D campaigns, I've had exactly 1 Druid in a game that wasn't Ange.
You know, and you know, I kind of picked Druid because I've been playing 5th edition D&D since 2015, and what haven't I played? I haven't played a druid. Let's give that a try.
Of course, the first thing I do is like take away one of the like your most iconic abilities. I'm like, if you're going to be a star seer and have this starry form, you can't change into animals. Are you okay with that?
Like,
that
I'm actually fine with that because I think with the Starlight Druid wild shape, you are allowed to use the Starlight forms that you get. And I was like, I'm probably going to lean into those far more than changing into an animal of any kind. And, you know, I suppose it could be limiting because there is some actual mechanical tactical advantage to druids and their wild shape in fights because you can change yourself into a moose, get beat on, and get beat back until the moose hit points are gone, and suddenly you're yourself with all the hit points you had when you transformed into a moose.
Or you can turn into a deer because we know that's the most advantageous form that you can take based on the D&D movie.
I mean, it's pretty good, right?
But yeah. What's funny is I actually played a Circle of Stars druid, obviously not Chris's customized version. I have never used wild shape to turn into an animal with that character.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to highlight that. I mean, you're going to ask me a question about homebrewing at some point in time. I'm just going to like abscond with that question right now, at least for a second. We can talk about it more later. Like, I'm like, well, can we lean more into the idea of these Circle of Stars druids, especially because the druids of this world, like they came from the Zithian Empire. Like that is a thing that happened as a result of what happened with the Titan, where you're talking about homebrewing and lore and like matching mechanics with story. I'm like, well, this is just one of the paths that they took. And one of the paths that they took was like, they started like studying the stars. And by studying the stars, they started to be able to predict the future. And as magic came back, they started to be able to mesh their magic that they were developing with that prediction and such. But then also, Ange is, not every Circle of Stars druid is like this, but Ange in particular, Odie, and some other druids are descended from starlight elementals. And that allows them to have their starry forms. Not even every druid can use starry form, even in the Circle of Druids, Circle of Star Druids.
So here's a question. Had you put any thought into the starlight druids before I told you?
No, not at all.
I wanted to play a druid?
No. That choice affected the story of the game and the story of the campaign. I didn't do any of that work until you were like, I'm playing a druid. I'm like, all right, what druid? Circle of Stars. I'm like, okay, let me look at them. I'm like, well, how can I do this? All right, let me pattern match all this stuff together and make it work.
And I think for our listeners who are looking at homebrewing, that right there is the key to get your players invested. Take the things that they're interested in, that they want to do with their characters, and weave it into your world. Because as a GM, you can create whatever world you want, but unless the players feel like their characters have a place in that world, it kind of like, okay, whatever. It'd be smacking an ogre in Faerun or Eberron or wherever. It doesn't matter. I'm just a character here hitting bad guys. But if you take the things that they want and weave it into the world, I mean, I'm invested in what goes on with Odie because, you know, Starlight Elemental and magic that none of the other druids have? What is going on? I need to know more.
Mm-hmm. What I think is funny, too, is I do not believe Ange or I did this on purpose, but I remember reading through some of this stuff and you telling us, like, you know, that arcane spellcasters do all this neat stuff where they learn how to use magic by tapping into the Titan shards, and, you know, this is what they're using for components and for spellbooks and all of this. And then both of us pick spellcasting classes that are outside of that paradigm completely.
Perfectly fine. It's still in the game. It just is, you know, NPCs have access to it, right? Titan shards are still magic items. Titan shards are still some amount of power, and they've and it's not just like it is a catch-all name for a bunch of different kinds of magic and magic items.
It is neat though, because it's given us a chance to, when we do encounter people that interface with magic that way, it contrasts us to those NPCs.
It really does.
Which I kind of like.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, As you said, we chose these characters, which caused you to figure out how to adapt them into the setting. I chose druid because I hadn't played a druid. And while the idea of the Titan Shards sounded cool, I didn't want to play a sorcerer because I've got a sorcerer that's in a long-running game already. I didn't want to play a wizard because I'd already played a wizard with Jared as another player in the game, and I didn't really want to revisit that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do a warlock or anything like that, or a bard. Let's do a druid. And like, it's all these other decisions in the background that made me decide druid, which then pushed Chris into the direction he went.
The class stuff is fine, right? Like, I love that those things happen to make that, but it was really the other things about the characters that I thought were super interesting, which, I mean, I suppose I'll just wait because you're going to ask a question about that and then I will answer the question. So I'm just preempting a question again. Sorry.
I was going to say, is it worth like touching base on what we originally thought of when we were coming up with our characters? Because I know you asked us, like, what kind of characters do you want to play? Yeah. And then both of us kind of came up with, you know, like Ange's thought process that she was going through there. Was there anything else you had going on in your brain there, Ange?
Nope. I just, you know, the idea was, you know, I wanted to play a druid because I hadn't played a druid. I didn't want to do a melee character because I was actively playing Selena. I didn't want to do a sorcerer because I'm actively playing Dove. I didn't want to do all these other things that kind of cascaded down to be druid. And then because I was playing Horizon Forbidden West, some of her look is modeled on Aloy. except, you know, dark hair instead of red hair. That was generally what was happening in my head at the time.
I thought that Odie was actually a lot harder than Aramon for me because I had to do the thing where I had to try to find things that would stick for Odie as far as like story arc stuff for a character. Because like I said, classes are one thing, right? But there's a thing about characters and who they are that matters to me a lot. And I think it plays a lot better in an AP also, but I also just do this for all my regular games. I had to like really listen and pay attention and think really hard after like the first like session. Like her book read idealism in the face of the real world was a thing that I'm like, cool, I'm going to latch onto that and try to push on that. Her being part of an order that she doesn't know anything about and how she'll feel about them when she learns what they actually are. Like, it's another thing that I could push on. Her orphan status, which, man, that's like the thing that you're not supposed to do is make an orphan. I'm like, I can make this work. Let's figure it out. So they're all kind of open things that Ange didn't specifically say anything about. So I get to just throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks, which is what I've done. And hopefully Ange has been enjoying it. That's the goal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And like the funny thing is with the her being an orphan, I'm like, I don't even know why. I guess in the back of my head, I was like, maybe her parents are elsewhere and she was sent with Noelle because Noelle could train her. But then it was just like, as things progressed, it was like, no, nah, she's grown up with Noelle. I have no idea why. She just, Noelle is all she's known.
It's okay. I have a couple of ideas of why.
And I think Odie is so pragmatic that she's just like, okay, Noelle was fine. I don't have any complaints.
Yeah, this would be different if Odie was like, my parents are dead. Orphan.
I mean, it'd be a different character, right? I mean, that's kind of Aramon's character, right? Aramon, tell us about what you wanted.
So I didn't work from class first. I was thinking I wanted to play someone that was, but first off, we talked a little bit about your ideas about the setting and that there's a knighthood here and all this stuff like that. And I kind of got this idea that I wanted to play someone like D'Artagnan. So I was thinking about the whole thing with, you know, D'Artagnan's father being a musketeer and him heading off into the city to, you know, join up. And, you know, how that, you know, gets him to meet the three musketeers and all of that. But I thought, but what if when that goes to happen, he doesn't want to be the knight? He's actually called to do something else. And from there, I was like, oh, what if D'Artagnan actually felt like he was called to be a paladin right before he headed off to become a musketeer? And that's kind of where everything started falling into place for what I wanted to do with Aramon.
Yeah, that made it a lot easier on me to pattern match a few things together. Then I asked you about it or if you wanted to bring in the relationship character of Robin.
I think you mentioned the character, and I think I latched onto it once we started. I think it kind of evolved from something else that we were talking about.
Well, that's good. See, that's to me, that's good collaboration.
The thing between Aramon and Robin has been there from the very beginning.
It has. I just can't remember if it came from Jared, if it came from me, or if it came from a collaboration. Probably a collaboration. Because it was, you know, last year.
Yeah.
At this point. But with that, then I could latch onto some of that stuff. It's this idea of duty versus personal desire. Duty versus like duty to a higher calling versus duty to one's parents.
He keeps saying duty.
I do keep saying duty. And those things are kind of the core of who Aramon is, aside from being a himbo that is kind of oblivious, which is hilarious.
But he's our himbo.
He is. He's our himbo.
That's just a little sprinkle of Porthos in with the D'Artagnan there.
But for me, those two things, like those things that I can kind of push on idealistically in the game to go along with the fighting and the high action and the big damn hero stuff and the epic fantasy tropes, to me, that's what makes the game more of a story and less a series of just related events. Like that through line of those characters makes the game sing for me. That's what I'm always looking for.
What kind of mechanical things did you end up creating for the campaign?
An altered subclass. This Star Seer Circle of Stars Druid monstrosity that I put together. It's great. I love it. I think it's a lot of fun. I wanted to really highlight it by giving you more uses of starry form and then more starry forms to utilize, which then maybe go and invent a calendar because the, you know, the months are the constellations. I've invented lots and lots of monsters and NPC stat blocks, some magic items. I've altered magical abilities, especially on the fly for things like Aramon. Like, Aramon's divine sense does not work as it is written in the player's handbook.
I mean, divine sense is written is kind of...
bad? It's just bad.
Yeah.
Right, like, it's a cool power that should do cool things, right? And it, to me, it's a fictional positioning thing that lets you detect bad magics. And in this case, the bad magics is Valhalla Morris's slurred.
As written, it kind of, like, doesn't do anything.
It's one of those things that it's useful in a limited set of circumstances if you happen to remember to say that you want to use it in a circumstance where it is useful. You know, it's one of those things where in a niche, this could be really useful, but you may never think to use it in that niche, so it may just not work.
Yeah.
So I like having it as a more, like, paladin sense instead.
Yeah, I know when I revive the Depths of Zendrick campaign, I'm probably going to talk with my paladin player and figure out something that's thematically appropriate for his character to kind of replace that feature.
It is perfectly mechanically well written as it is for, like, a standard stock D&D game.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you start utilizing things that are not D&D, or, like, you go outside of the D&D worlds and you're not using demons and devils and, what is it, Fae?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's super limited.
You really need to do some work to make that particular feature work a little bit better. And it's a cool feature, right? It's a divine sense, like, that should matter. Like, it sounds cool. There were other things, too. What else did I change? I've changed some of the rules as far as, like, how... I've altered the rules for situations. That's what I do. Not everything is always just a standard skill check. Sometimes it's a descending skill check. Like, I start the DC at, like, 30. And you roll, and if you fail by less than a certain number, it drops the DC down. Like, I use that to replace the idea of the skill challenge. But sometimes I'll use a skill challenge. It depends on the situation. I will do levels of success in this game at times, which is not a thing that's in the D&D rules. But then I will also, when I do that, lay out what the stakes are for the roll and what it means to hit each of those so that you have an understanding of what's going on. But then I will just discard that rule after that situational moment because it's for a situation. That's how I tend to run games anyway, so there's probably other rules.
I was just going to say, I like the extrapolating the idea that Lay on Hands can remove certain conditions.
That's the one I was going to get onto. I forgot about it.
To remove some conditions that are kind of unique to this game.
Yep.
Yeah.
I also invented two new damage types. There's Dreaming and Starlight. Like, those two damage types are specifically for certain types of, to oppose certain types of Titan things.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably other stuff, but I can't think of it offhand. Any other questions?
So do any of the mechanical elements that you've brought in come from other games you've run before?
I'm sure there are. That descending DC thing, I'm sure it came from some other game. I tend to pull concepts from all sorts of role-playing games, then adapt them for the 2014 rule set, or the 5e rule set, I should say. I don't even barely use the 2014 rule set. It's just there is a guideline. It's like the Pirate's Code. It's just a guideline.
Really. Yeah, and I mean, it's been out for long enough that we've been running it for a decade, you know, at this point, running or playing it for a decade. So it's going to get adapted to our personal tastes and needs.
I do that. I've been doing that since, you know, day one, probably. I'm sure I ran the game properly to begin with.
I don't even want to contemplate how much money I have invested in third-party products that I can just look around my desk and see that are just all about trying to figure out how to modify this rule set to do additional things.
Yeah, and like some level of like the madness mechanics and whatnot, the more condition type stuff that is more sticky than what we have, and not exhaustion, because man, exhaustion was not great in the 2014 rules. Great concept, just not a great implementation.
Yeah, I much preferred one of the versions of exhaustion they had one of the early 2024 playtests. I think that's what I adapted into the Zendrick game, because it was much more interesting.
The minus ones are pretty solid.
Yeah.
It feels right, too, right? You're just more worn down, so you have less capability, but it's only like in 5% increments. That makes sense to me.
And like, I think the original rules kind of didn't take into account how absolutely devastating rolling everything with disadvantage would be.
Yeah, it's essentially a minus five, and even worse than that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the mathematics, like, I think, pair out that way. Like, minus five, but worse.
Yeah.
Because you're capped.
Yeah, there's a minus five, and then there's the having your movement rate, which, once you start thinking in terms of combat, this is just really hammering that character to where it's like, I can't get across the room to do anything, and if I can get across the room to do something, I'm not likely to succeed.
Yep.
Yeah, man, disadvantage on anything is terrible.
It's a good mechanic.
Yeah, I love it as like a momentary thing, but something that's a permanent issue for a character, that gets a little much.
You want to talk about a mechanic that I messed up, that I realized I messed up, and then I had to like shift it later? The slurg, when they hit you with that living mud that gets on you and gives you disadvantage on everything, the thing that it shouldn't give you disadvantage on is getting rid of it. Because it's almost impossible to get rid of it then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, it just did, because I didn't write that in there. In later sessions, I did just stop making that a disadvantage roll to get rid of it, because I'm like, oh, this is dumb. Like, it's like a death spiral at that point.
Aramon would have it in his small clothes forever.
In his small clothes forever. Because if you fail having it twice or three times, you die. Like, you're just dead. That's how it works.
It's funny, too, because when you bring that up, it reminds me, I keep thinking of other games. It reminds me in the new Marvel Multiverse game, there's the web slinging ability let you trap somebody, but the DC mm-hmm. they put on it, you could not escape if you were a tier one or two character. You just can't.
It was something like 20, right? It was like 20 or something like that. Yeah. Although, to be fair, like the characters were like level, what, Spider-Man's like 4 and 5 rank, 3 and 4 ranks. Right?
Yeah, but the thing is, you can get that ability lower than that. So it's not like it is a rank 4 ability. You can get that at like rank 2.
I know this is a D&D podcast, but man, if you wanted to talk about a game that has terrible rules for character creation, that game's got terrible rules for character creation. Just play the stuff that's presented in the books, please. Do not play your original characters in the Marvel role-playing game. What are you doing? Like, stop it. Like, I shouldn't say that. You can do whatever you want. I don't care. But man, those rules are bad for character creation.
But it is funny, though, because like you were saying, though, they did release a thing saying, now, no, just make it 15. Don't make it 20.
It's better.
Are there any mechanics we're going to be interacting with that we haven't seen yet and that you don't mind sharing?
Probably. We've played about, what, 20 hours of game together at this point. I mean, I've been running this version, the 5e version of the game for over a decade, and I have plenty of things that I've done that I just don't get rid of. I mean, I haven't used the reverse gravity in an area against you guys yet, with which have my rules for that kind of stuff. I haven't rolled out the teleporting puzzle trap set while fighting something terrible. I might never do it. We haven't had a chase yet. And that is my own special brand of mechanic, because chase mechanics are mostly terrible.
So
I have my own chase mechanics that I use that I think are much better, that I've been developing for like years and years.
You mentioned chases, and I have PTSD about that Dragon Heist campaign where only two characters engaged in the actual chase.
That's the thing. Like, we have to agree that we're in a chase. We have to agree what the stakes are for the chase. And we have to say, okay, who's running after this person, right? Like, and if you're not, then okay, you're going to opt out of being part of the thing.
As a discussion on this now, since I am playing a paladin, I am just going to promise you now, I'm not going to prepare a compelled duel, because compelled duel is basically, let's not have a chase. That's the actual name of that spell. Because that's what I've seen it used for in all of my campaigns.
If you did that to me and you compelled a duel, I would just have that person consistently attack you while outranging you. Like, well, we're still fighting. So here's the thing about my chase mechanics. It always assumes that you're moving. You don't get a move action because you're always moving. So you just have all your other actions at your disposal. And if you have like a speed bonus thing, that just gives you an advantage, on a roll to do a thing. That way, then we are in the idea that we're always just constantly in motion for a chase, because that's how chases actually work. We're always just moving. And then you can take actions to try to do things and whatnot. And then, of course, compelled duel, maybe that could potentially end the chase if that is like the mechanic if the mechanic is catch the person, and compelling a duel is a magical effect that would catch a person, then it could work, but they could resist it too. So then they would still get away. I mean, you guys still have your magical abilities and whatnot. You don't want to shortchange people and things like that. Although on a compelled duel and a chase, I might give them advantage on that roll because they're trying to get away.
Whoops, I forgot to tell you, they have legendary resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do that. I know. I mean, maybe they do have that, right?
Yeah.
So has there been anything you thought you were going to have in the game that you ended up changing because of our actions?
Honestly, no. You're both down with taking the hook so easily, and hopefully I'm giving compelling enough reasons for you guys to take hooks, so none of this really feels forced to me. What about you folks? Do you think that do I give compelling enough reasons?
I think other than, I can't talk about that yet. There was one point where Odie has to tell Aramon, we are doing this thing, we're not doing that thing. And I can't really go into details on that, but in general, I haven't felt forced into any particular path.
Strangely enough, you could have went and done the other thing too. It just would have meant that other bad things would have happened.
I mean, that's always the interesting thing. And this is speaking of things that could be a whole other podcast. To me, having one path that is most likely, if you know that your characters are heroic characters that they will follow, is not railroading, especially if you let people do the thing in their own way and you aren't telling them exactly how to do the thing. You're just kind of assuming that they will do this thing that is consistent with their character.
And I think as a player, there is also a point of respecting the effort that your GM has put into preparing for the game. Because sure, you know, the GM doesn't want a railroad, but the GM needs to put their effort into the things they think you're going to engage with. I think we've all played with those players who choose to deliberately go against the hooks being presented because they want to be contrary. They want to be obnoxious. And as a result, they make the GM have to scramble, you know, if the GM's even willing to do it, scramble to put together something on a fly because they've completely decided to not engage with the thing that the GM has obviously prepared. And like, I've never felt railroaded in the Heroes game at all. It feels like there's definitely a path that our characters are on, but it's never felt like a railroad. You know, we've always been like, no, I want to go do this or I want to do that.
And when you've asked for things, I usually just try to work that into the play of the game.
Yeah.
That's also been a good thing, though, too, is at the end of the game, we will talk about things that we want to do or what we want to see happen so that we can signpost that way before it comes up and you have ways to work that in so that it's not just, surprise, I want to do this. Deal with it now.
I'm a big Stars and Wishes fan.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you have to put up with doing whatever the GM puts in front of you. Like, if what the GM is putting down on the table for the group is not engaging, it's not fun, you can explain that that's not drawing your attention. You don't want to disregard their work, but your character doesn't really have a reason to engage with whatever it is they're putting down in front of you. That's a conversation you need to have at the table about what the game is and where it's going.
Yeah.
But you should always like give the GM kind of the benefit of the doubt and try, if at all possible, to take the hooks.
Yeah. Find reasons to be invested, for your character to be invested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, ask yourself, why would my character care about this? And don't say they wouldn't. Say, what way would they care about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is a sign of a higher quality of player, right? Like, because you're actually looking to contribute to storytelling instead of blocking storytelling.
I've gotten to the point where if I just know if I run into a player who is refusing to engage with what I'm putting down, if it's a one shot, I'll tell them, okay, if you want to just sit here and watch everyone else play, that's fine. Or if it's a campaign, I'll be like, that's great for that character. Now who are you going to make that actually wants to engage with the game? You know, I've been playing for too long to want to try and twist myself into a pretzel to accommodate a player and their character that doesn't want to engage with the rest of the table.
I used to be that way. Like, I used to get the thing like, man, just take the hook and whatnot. And then I had thought about it for a long time. Like, I was like, is there a better way that I can go about doing this? Is there a better way that I can get players to engage with this stuff, or even to get them to tell me how they want to engage with this stuff? And that's just, like you said, if that player, if that person is just doing everything to not engage, then the question that I tend to ask is, what would get your character to engage with this? And the answer can't be they won't.
Yeah.
Right.
If you can't tell me that, then you don't want to play this game. Like, I can't help you at that point. You have to tell me what would make that character want to do the thing.
And I can't remember whether it was on an episode of this, because I know we still drift into talking about comic books on here too, or on an episode of the Gnomecast, but it really reminds me of the thing that Claremont said when he was writing the X-Men early on. People always cite Wolverine as that like loner character that, you know, goes off and does his own thing. And Claremont's whole thing that he was saying is Wolverine always wanted to belong. He wants to be part of the team. It's, you know, deep down, he really doesn't want to be the loner. He doesn't want to go off on his own. So even those people that think they're playing the Wolverine, they're not. It's just that he won't admit it. He doesn't want people to think that he cares, but he does care. And that's that thing that I think is kind of important to understand what a character says versus what a character actually is.
One of the very first blog articles I ever wrote about gaming was about the reluctant hero and how the way people play it tends not to work in games where you have somebody who does your Bilbo who doesn't want to go on the adventure, or your Peter Parker who just wants to make some money with his powers, or the Sam Winchester who really doesn't want to go monster hunting again. These are all viable character ideas, but you can't stop there. You have to be like, okay, why does Bilbo eventually choose to go on the adventure? Why does Peter eventually choose to take up the mantle of Spider-Man and become a hero? Why does Sam agree to go on? And you can't, especially in a game with multiple players, you can't put that responsibility on the GM to make that happen for your character. You have to be able to figure it out for your character yourself.
I like your examples, but I also started laughing because 2/3 of your answers were kill somebody they care about.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was scrambling to remember. And I specifically wrote that article because I was tired of playing with other people's characters that would actively work against the adventure the GM was bringing to the table, because that's not what their character would do.
In a lot of ways, Jared did that with Aramon. Aramon is a reluctant hero that chose to not be a knight, mm-hmm. and then chose to embrace the dreamer. So he didn't choose the adventure earlier, he chose the adventure later. The only difference is that it happened before the game started.
Yeah.
So you could just work it into your backstory, right? Like, yep. And then we don't need a lot. Like, it came up in our game. That was part of the conversations that occurred in the first session. Because I'm all about the classic storytelling is like the first time you were offered adventure, you reject the adventure, and then you take the adventure later because that is because you don't want your world to change. You're not ready for your world to change yet.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what's been great about this is it very much. Chris obviously has an idea and he's obviously building things out, but it has also felt very collaborative with what we're doing, so that we are invested in this. It is not just we are showing up to play Chris's story.
No, I mean, we're showing up to play our story. Like, the character's story is the story. Like, the plot is just what happens as we're going along, really.
And I think that might be the most important lesson of world building, is it's not just your world. It is yours and the player's world.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't build it, I don't mean you have to sit there at the table with your players with something like Microscope or Decima and actually create your world from nothing. You can totally do that. That is totally viable. But if you don't make the world something that your players feel like their characters live and breathe in, it's not going to have as much impact.
That's
as like,
goal.
I mean, you've listened to us gush for the last hour about how invested our characters are in the journey they're on. And that's because Chris has worked with the ideas we've given him and made it a home for our characters.
That's the goal.
Now let's join Ange and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
So moving into downtime research, every episode we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to you, our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. Before we do that, though, we're going to chill for our Patreon.
Yay, Patreon!
We have a Patreon!
Woo!
So if you'd like to help us do this show and provide some additional content for you, we'd love it if you'd decide to join. We've got our very own Discord, and we are releasing additional supplementary material, like a lot of the things Chris has already mentioned about the campaign we're playing.
Yeah, by the time you hear this, there'll be like 4 PDF documents about the Hovel's Way campaign. There are 4 PDFs of like spells that me and Jared have been making for just extra spells. New things like beanstalk. You can just make a beanstalk. Plus, there's my commentaries on what I was thinking when I was running the game that are in there too. Plus, whatever Jared comes up with that I just decide to release. I mean, there was the first week of Swordtember that's out there. I don't know if there's 3 more weeks of Swordtember somewhere. If there are, I should go lay them out.
Actually, some of the other prompts were not as easy to turn into game rules. So,
oh, okay.
But I do, on this topic, have that worksheet on world building if you're interested in looking at that.
Yep, there's that too.
Well, either way, we've got some very cool stuff on the Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/thack0wa. And we'll obviously have a link in the show notes.
And while we're talking about our Patreon, I'd like to thank some of our patrons. Matea the Sorceress, the Polish Ogre, Doug Ross, and Victor Wyatt. Thank you so much for being our patrons. Ange, what do you got? What's cool out there in the world?
So in the middle of November, I am going to be at UConn in Ann Arbor, Michigan. UConn is a fantastic little con that is 3 solid days of gaming. They have a very strong Adventures League presence there. But there's also plenty of other great games and a lot of board games. I believe the hotel is sold out at this point, and I'm not even sure you could get a hotel. You know, basically, if you happen to be near Ann Arbor, Michigan, it's worth checking out. It's a great little con. We'll have a link in the show notes.
I wanted to talk about MT Black's newsletter. I don't know if anyone here knows who MT Black is. MT Black is a pretty prolific D&D adventure designer and content creator. Go look him up on the DM's Guild. You'll see tons and tons of stuff. His newsletter always has 10 D&D / RPG related cool little articles that he's found, and then some stuff that he's working on, and often some free something or another world building content or game related content. For instance, in his last newsletter, which I get it every week, there's a bit about role playing tips, how to remove dull adventure hooks from that website, from the role playing tips website. It's pretty good. I read it. There's also, he always collects a bunch of cool stuff. Like there's the Cobalt Press on there thing about the KP encounter builder. Talks a little bit about that. And then his little bit was like handling player absence in this one. But there's always all sorts of different stuff. Love it a lot. You should go and I'll have a link in the show notes. Go and subscribe to it if you want to get like 10 cool D&D things a week.
Darrington Press has opened up their pre-orders for Daggerheart, which is the Critical Role RPG that they have been playtesting. And you can hear Chris and I discuss this with Sean Merwin on an episode of Misdirected Mark if you would like to. The game is set to be out in spring of 2025, and there are 2 different bundles available for the pre-order. The first one is $59.99, which gets you access to the PDF, about a 300-page hardcover rulebook, and a box with all of the neat cards that have all of the class and, you know, abilities that you use to build your character. And for $150, you get a limited edition version, which has a different cover, a bigger box that stores more stuff, a GM screen, a dice set, a token set, and all of those neat things. So we will have a link in the show notes. I'm actually kind of interested to see the token set and to see how utilitarian that is for tracking the things that you need to track in the game, because that would be really handy if they do what they need to do for that.
I want that game. I should go order it. I'm not going to right now, but I will probably in the future.
I'm definitely tempted to go in on the higher level one too, just because I want the stuff.
Yeah. It's too much. $150 is too much for me. $60 is about right.
Yeah, I'm looking at it going, I can probably justify the $60, but as shiny as that $149.99 is, I can't.
That's really expensive.
I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to be a financially, fiscally responsible human being.
I am a little shocked, though, that the entry level at 60 still has the box with all the cards, because printing, you know, those custom cards is not cheap.
No, it's not. We could talk about that more in a little bit, but first, we should talk about the Gnomecast. That's a show that's on Polygamers Podcast Network. That's where several gnomes from Gnome Stew get together and talk about gaming topics. They also talk about themselves, and they do that to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew. Hopefully there's some knowledge there. Otherwise, they get to be gnomy bits that we all get to eat. Gross.
We've used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.